And we'll turn on the auto transcript as well for anyone for whom that's helpful. I also want to let you know that we will be uploading a full transcript to the CCB website in the coming weeks. So welcome again to the kickoff for the Celebrating 75 Years of the Center for Children's Books. Of course, we had hoped that we could gather in person to celebrate this important moment in the center's history, but COVID has conspired against us. The upside of being is, of course, being able to welcome so many visitors, including alumni from afar, and we are just delighted that you are here to help us mark this occasion. Before I begin, I want to thank those who helped to make this anniversary series possible. Our four faculty and alumni speakers, Drs. Betsy Hearn, Kate McDowell, Sarah Park Dallin, and Dipesh Navsaria. I want to thank Diana Stroud and the iSchool Advancement Office for connecting me as a new director to our fabulous alumni, to Jen Anderson and her team at the Help Desk, and the CCB GAs, Josh Altshuler, Alexandra Byerly, and Helen Salkeld for quickly pivoting this series to our webinar platform. Before I introduce Betsy Hearn, our distinguished speaker, I'd like to share a very brief history of the CCB. And in doing so, I must acknowledge our MLIS student, Josh Altshuler, who has spearheaded the creation of an online exhibit on the CCB for our anniversary year. My overview today stems from that work, which in turn builds on the history of the center written by Lila Friedenberg, a CCB graduate assistant in 1997 and 98, and subsequently director of administrative services at Rutgers University Libraries. We will be making the online multimedia exhibit live through the new CCB website later this spring. So, a very brief history of the CCB. What is now the Center for Children's Books had its origin at the University of Chicago, where in 1945, librarian Alice Brooks McGuire, director of the Center for Instructional Materials, began reviewing newly published children's books and collecting her reviews into a memorandum distributed on a small scale within the university and among the center's patrons. This memo proved quite popular, and in 1947, McGuire and Mary Catherine Eakin, librarian at the university's Reader Center, published volume one, number one of the newly titled Service Bulletin of the Center for Instructional Materials. This was the beginning of what would become the Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books. In the late 1940s, the center received from publishers approximately 75% of the 900 plus new children's books released in the United States annually. Today, the CCB receives nearly 4,500 titles for review annually. So what to do with all those books? Beginning in the early 1950s, the Bulletin staff began retaining for a period of 5 years the books that it had received from publishers and which they had recommended in their service bulletin. At the end of that 5 year period, some books were retained for a permanent collection and others were sent to the Midwest Interlibrary Center located close to the University of Chicago campus. These books, both those retained at the Center for Children's Books and those transferred to the Midwest Interlibrary Center, later Center for Research Libraries, play an important role in both today's CCB collection housed in Daniel 5 and in the S collection at the UIUC Main Library. When the University of Chicago closed its library school in 1990, then Bulletin editor Betsy Hearn worked with UIUC Dean Lee Esterbrook to bring the Bulletin, the center's books, herself and her staff to Urbana-Champaign. In addition to bolstering the study of youth librarianship at Urbana-Champaign, the move helped to make the university's S collection the largest collection of children's literature in the United States outside the Library of Congress. 25% of today's catalog collection can be traced directly to the movement of books from Chicago to Urbana. Moreover, each year since the early 1990s, the CCB has transferred boxes and boxes and boxes of children's books to the S collection, forming a rich base for researchers and an accessible working collection for students training to be librarians, K-12 educators, and youth advocates. Professor Hearn will be taking up the story from here, placing the Bulletin's book evaluation in context of both other review journals and the changing nature of youth literature from the post-war years to the pandemic present. I know she needs no introduction to this community, but I'd like to formally, if briefly, introduce her nonetheless. Betsy Hearn is Professor Emerita at the School of Information Sciences, where she served as director for the Center for Children's Books between 2004 and 2007, and editor of the Bulletin between 1985 and 1994, continuing as a consulting editor until 2007. A renowned expert in folklore and storytelling, as well as in evaluating children's literature, her scholarly writings include Beauty and the Beast, Visions and Revisions of an Old Tale, Beauties and Beasts, the Oryx Multicultural Folk Tale Series, Choosing Books for Children, A Common Sense Guide, third edition, and Evaluating Children's Books, A Critical Look. She's the author of more than 10 works of fiction and poetry for children published by HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, and Macmillan, and Anthem. At the CCB, Betsy Hearn not only navigated the successful institutional move from Chicago to Urbana, thereby ensuring that we reached the 75th anniversary, she also innovated. When she took the reins from Zena Sutherland, whose editing tenure stretched three decades, Betsy transformed the Bulletin and Center from a planetary system that orbited around one into a webbed hub of collaboration. As we pause to celebrate 75 years of accomplishment at the CCB, current youth services faculty take seriously that model of melding our expertise and service for children. We remain cognizant of the limitations of any one of our worldviews. As I've stepped into the role of CCB director these past 18 months, I stand in awe of all that Betsy accomplished under her watch. It's been a great pleasure to listen to her spin stories about the CCB and her career, and I'm honored to pass the mic to her now so you too can be the beneficiary of her wisdom. So.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much. I think you should just keep going, okay? So some of this will be a little bit repetitive and I may skip sections, but we'll see. The Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books was just turning 40 years old when I became editor in 1985, and I was turning 43. Now I'm 78 and she's 75. And we've each changed considerably. What has stayed the same is our mutual engagement with stories, pictures, and nonfiction, though both of us became more nuanced in critique and varieties of expression. But let me begin with a bird's eye view of book evaluation and selection in review journals dedicated to youth literature. A logical starting point would be the founding dates of the Big Four, as we call ourselves with a certain self-satisfaction. Booklist was founded in 1905, the Horn Book Magazine in 1924, the Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books in 1945, and School Library Journal in 1954. Just a few reminders, Booklist, which published twice a month, is owned by the American Library Association, the Bulletin published monthly by the iSchool, Horn Book published every other month, and School Library Journal published monthly. Both include articles as well as reviews and are owned by Media Source Incorporated. Booklist, Horn Book, and The Bulletin, with their in-house staff reviewers and small stable of outside reviewers, are the most consistent in terms of literary evaluation. School Library Journal, relying primarily on widely distributed field reviewers, is most consistent in terms of varied exposure to youth in the field. The Bulletin, I might add, was consistent in the extreme. For 27 years, Zena Sutherland wrote all the reviews with a weekly committee who considered her ratings of R, AD, NR, or SPR, but who were not encouraged to talk. That changed when I became editor and hired my first full-time reviewer and associate editor, the inimitable Roger Sutton, whom I wrote into the budget despite administration and resistance. And at that point, suddenly there was a lot of talking. I worked as editor in two of the Big Four journals and published reviews and or articles in all of them. Book review editors and book editors knew each other well. Book review editors also knew many authors and illustrators personally through frequent conference meetings and panel presentations. I still have a photograph of Lloyd Alexander's bony hand pointing at my pregnant belly in a 1969 party thrown by another Booklist reviewer, Lloyd's observation being the ever-evolving presence of new readers. I was certainly acquainted with all the major authors, illustrators, and editors or publishers in the world of youth literature then, and especially close friends with some of them: Virginia Hamilton, Julius Lester, Susan Cooper, Trina Shart Hyman, Margaret McElderry, to name a few. But I never hesitated to pass their books on to other reviewers if I had doubts, and would of course be challenged in my judgment by staff and my always outspoken review committee. In preparing for this celebration of BCCB's 75th year, I paged through all the volumes during my association with the Bulletin. It was a humbling experience. Navigating the quantity and quality of the journal's content, its close encounters with extinction, and the deadly pressure of all those years was unsettling. But reconnection with those authors, illustrators, publishers, and memorable titles, which I duly listed in alphabetical order, also brought back the exhilaration and camaraderie that sustained the whole endeavor. Short of money and glory, good company goes a long way. This was not unlike the alliance formed by the first women to become children's book editors during the 1920s to 1940s publishing world dominated by men. But it was quite unlike the children's book world that was taken over in the 1980s and 90s by a different kind of competitive system akin to adult publishing, which featured revolving acquisition mergers, royalties-driven celebrity contracts, and ownership by business corporations unrelated to books or even media. I think one owned a lipstick company. They took over Random House briefly. Amidst the earlier 20th century sense of togetherness, though each journal had a different approach, review policy, and staffing system, all were oriented toward the major youth literature market of public and school libraries. Publishers and editors courted librarians as their primary buyers, especially librarians on award committees, which guaranteed significant and permanent presence as authoritative book evaluation meters. Librarians were the gatekeepers of book evaluation throughout the 20th century. Their purchase power sometimes negatively or positively affected by federal funding, including a 1960s surge that meant school library budget could afford to buy everything they wanted without much discrimination. Commonly, large library systems got review copies, had their own internal children's and young adult evaluators, and also used the big four journals, while smaller systems relied variously on one or two journals, often shared. Bookstore sales didn't grow until the 1980s, with phenomena like increasing emphasis on parental involvement with early literacy and expansive genre of baby board books. Family buyers were oriented very differently from professional library buyers. Picture books made better impulse buys than less visually appealing novels and nonfiction for older readers. Harry Potter and his film presence would not amaze the market till the end of the 20th century, nor would direct communication among book creators, their audiences, and lay reviewers thrive on widespread social and commercial media till then. Meanwhile, youth literature reviewers who were rooted in the library world, we ruled. Their reviews largely determined what books would be bought and therefore what books might enter the canon. Book reviewing at its best is craft, art, advocacy, and a partnered waltz between knowledge of literature and knowledge of young people. Experience counts, but which experience? A full-time staff who see all the books published annually make different calls than a librarian in the field who writes only an occasional review and sees a limited selection of what's published, but who works with many children. Someone who brings awareness to long-term cyclical publishing trends brings a different perspective than someone who keeps tabs on what books are circulating currently with young patrons, parents, and teachers. One of the assignments I often gave in my courses on children's literature was to review the reviewers, comparing the same book reviewed across four big journals, the big four journals. Brevity and balance count. The reviewer must both generalize the book about a book and document her or his overview with selective detail. And as in scholarship or research, balance is elusive. Objectivity during the 20th century was the gold standard for judgments and conclusions. Only slowly did acknowledgement spread that all conclusions, even scientifically determined ones, researchers bring biases shaped by personal experience and social environment. At Booklist, there was a lot of resistance when I initiated the children's staff signing our reviews, and we were the first section to do so. The resistance stemmed from the fact that to some extent, signing reviews diluted the powerful imprimatur of the American Library Association as an anonymous institution and revealed the personal identity behind book recommendations, which, by the way, were only positive according to long-established Booklist policy. Harriet the Spy, as I've written elsewhere, was not reviewed at Booklist, arguably because of its subversive nature, nor did it appear on ALA's notable books list in 1964. For those who relied solely on ALA for selection, the book could have been as good as buried. The intricate issues of censorship sometimes are impenetrable. As an aside from the Harriet type of problem, though I won the battle for signing reviews at Booklist, trying to introduce negative reviews there went nowhere. To some extent, this was historically understandable. Booklist was the oldest journal, and the first half of the 20th century was a period when librarians worked desperately to prove the value of literature for youth. They didn't want to tear that down in any way and mar the reputation. Famously, of course, all hell broke loose in the 1960s when social taboos were broken in youth literature, with resulting objections to reviewers' recommendations of taboo breakers. When I started publishing some of those letters of objection in the children's book section of Booklist, the range of objection from details of sex and reproduction to swear words was predictable, though there were a few surprises. Someone, for instance, protested Trina Shart Hyman's illustration of a bottle of wine included in Little Red Riding Hood's goodie basket for grandma. Challenges to the literature in toto as racist, from publication to consumption, was revolutionary in nature, if much more eventual and still evolving in effect. Ignorance and socially willed myopia count in assessing both substance and attitudes expressed in youth literature. In addition to sociocultural awareness, coverage of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry for all age groups is an impossible challenge. So reviewers have to learn their strengths and weaknesses, admit them, and work hard to overcome them. Perhaps this is a moment to back up for a more detailed timeline of my own professional history as it entwined with the bulletins. After working in public and school libraries and getting my master's at the University of Chicago's Graduate Library School, GLS, I started reviewing for ALA's Booklist in 1968, was appointed editor of the children's book section there in 1973, and then moved on to editing BCCB in 1985, after I got my PhD at the University of Chicago and joined its faculty. In some ways, my 13 years at Booklist barely prepared me to lead an academically affiliated book review journal, the only national one of its kind. Though collections such as the University of Wisconsin's Cooperative Center for Children's Books and many libraries' special lists served other purposes. My 22 years of involvement with the Bulletin as either editor or consulting editor faculty liaison were filled with dramatic developments in books for youth, in the art of reviewing them, and in the vicissitudes of the journal itself. Spoiler alert, we are about to enter the stormy waters of academic politics that some of you may recognize as having drowned a fleet of library schools. Shortly after I started at Chicago's GLS, the dean called me in to say that he was leaving to take a position elsewhere. The Chicago administration, under new budget constraints, took this opportunity to put GLS under review. And although we had been the number one library school in the country, managed to close it down within 7 years, based on the provost's opinion that the internet would make us all obsolete. With the development of computer technology, he asserted, every scholar would be his, no her, his own librarian. No further expertise or guidance through the brave new world of information was needed. The University of Chicago Press wanted to keep the journal there, but without departmental affiliation, BCCB would have lost its distinctively academic affiliation and the important ways that reviewing, teaching, research, and service, though presenting conflicts of time and energy, deeply enrich each other. When GLS closed in 1992 and Lee Esterbrook, then Dean of GISLS, now iSchool, navigated the journals and my move to UIUC, the Center and Bulletin emerged successfully from disaster and not only survived but thrived here, forming a magnetically active venue for many graduate students specializing in youth services librarianship, both public and school, about 33% of the student body at that time. Together, CCB and BCCB have provided a source for classroom readings and research assignments, a place to meet for joint research projects and storytelling presentations, an opportunity to expand critical expertise through exposure to new books and veteran reviewers' assessment of them, and a force in influencing what's bought for children's and young adult library collections nationally. But watching and experiencing book reviewing requires institutional and organizational support and becomes endangered when that is withdrawn. In this context of impermanence, adaptation is a requirement. And one of the most compelling aspects of BCCB's successful adaptations has been technology. Although not in contradiction to print tradition. Throughout its history, BCCB has required adaptation to innovative formats and equipment while maintaining reliance on traditionally proven knowledge and experience. When I took over the Bulletin, Zena Sutherland used a manual typewriter. My first assistant at the University of Chicago, John DeBacher, did not trust the university's mainframe computer, which took up an enormous space, as in almost an entire building, and insisted on installing Mac desktops, which gave us the flexibility we needed long after the mainframe became outmoded. Later on, Roger Sutton programmed my new computer to open with the words, quote, I am not my work, unquote, which I did not understand or embody till well after retirement. Nevertheless, while confused by my daily introduction to the concept of I am not my work, I continued to be my work on that computer. In 1995, GISLS initiated its LEAP program. We began to teach online. Thank you, Kate McDowell. I could not have done it without you. Including core courses in children's literature and young adult literature, storytelling, youth services. In February 96, during Roger's editorship, BCCB also went experimentally online. Thank you, Kate McDowell, though without the success of current versions. Now I listen breathlessly in the COVID-19 era as Deborah Stevenson, who joined BCCB as an editorial assistant at University of Chicago in 1989, and after years of incomparable work became editor in 2001, describes reading review copies that are submitted electronically, writing and editing reviews electronically, meeting with the reviewing committee electronically, and overseeing the electronic BCCB website content. I can hardly get it all out. Clearly, a new generation will take CCB in new directions, and I look on with grandmotherly affection, curiosity, and suspense as that happens. I also wonder what would be useful to pass on from a legacy of experience. During my decades of reviewing children's and young adult books, I cannot generalize what we learned, but I can say what I learned. The following is my catechism, based on the three most significant elements in my life as a book review editor: community, reading, and writing. Community, reading, and writing. First, here are some of the things I learned about community. I learned to foster and rely on a serial staff of brilliant professionals for reviewing and discussion, and on proficient, energetic graduate assistants who answered reference questions, maintained the bulletin's book processing, and organized many center events, from book sales to storytelling festival arrangements. I learned that although drafting reviews is a solitary endeavor, the final assessment and edits gain significantly from interactive feedback among internal staff and outside evaluators who work with young people on a daily basis. And I watched as public voices online broadened diversity of opinions and backgrounds. I learned from all this to listen to others' opinions, but not to abandon my own without good reasons. And I learned to share laughter about gauche titles, maladroit writing, or simply publishing puzzles. What the hell were they thinking? Second, here are some things I learned about reading. I learned in the midst of hosting 5,000 books a year, how to be selective in choosing what deserves attention, either positively or negatively, and then how to critique each book both on its own merit and in context with other books. I learned to identify new trends without becoming trendy. I learned to turn over genres I did not embrace, like science fiction, to reviewers who did, and to deepen my understanding of those I embraced. Among many other topics, I reviewed everything Jewish or related to the Holocaust and Israel, where I'd studied antisemitism at the Hebrew University. I also reviewed almost everything folkloric, which was my primary area of research, and which involved new surges of traditional, multicultural, and satirical versions of myths, tales, and folktales, legends. For a long time, I reviewed all things dog. No cats. And during a publishing period of expanded baby books, I reviewed many of those. Fortunately, I had an unexpected baby at the time, as well as deepening a focus on picture book illustration and introducing new aesthetic aspects of the journal, such as full color covers. Third, here are some things I learned about writing. I learned that the book will tell you what to say if you listen attentively. It can't help itself. It is what it is. I learned, as we say in the cancer ward, I learned to be clear with supportive evidence and service of the book and its consumers rather than showing off what I knew. I learned to think long and write short, which served me not only in reviewing, but also in scholarly research, children's books, and poetry. You will not believe that from the length of this lecture. I learned to write fast and meet short deadlines, reviewing about a book a day. There was no time for writer's block. That's a blessing, actually. One of my first priorities at BCCB was to become more current, reviewing from galleys so that librarians could order as soon as the books came out without a big lag time. I learned to push our limits. On my watch, the reviewers got longer and more specific, including the big picture, which not only highlighted a special title, but also extended the critical analysis to contextual commentary. Other new features included the Blue Ribbon's Best Books list, professional connection reviews, periodic explanations of editorial rationale for book selection and policy, and occasional columns by experts like Nancy O'Brien and Janice N. Harrington on African-American children's books. I learned both the power of strong writing and the limitations of its power. At Booklist in 1974, I wrote an editorial about the lack of nuance among the villains in Robert Cormier's theoretically realistic novel, The Chocolate War. My literary training at the University of Chicago and many years of educational background beforehand suggested that nuance was a valuable aspect of characterization. In brief, the human condition is complicated, and complicated depictions deepen our understanding of it. My piece, entitled, quote, Whammo, You Lose, unquote, incited a backlash against what was perceived as criticism of negativity in young adult literature, which is the farthest thing from my mind. But as you know, Cormier's book became a classic in the genre. Whammo, I lost. Another experience was a BCCB big picture I wrote about Disney's books based on his film version of Beauty and the Beast, an evaluation to which I brought decades of folkloric, literary, and historical research. The title was, quote, You Did It, Little Teacup, unquote, a reference to all those dancing dishes that helped save the day when the Beast castle was stormed by a crazed mob, another element that Disney's company introduced into the story. So Beauty, the real hero, gets edged into obscurity by singing China. You Did It, Little Teacup has now become an ironic byword in our family folklore. And Disney's book versions of Beauty and the Beast did quite well on the commercial market, thank you, despite my exceptionally well-informed intervention. On the other hand, here's some perspective. By its very nature, book reviewing is transient, but not transitory. We review new books, see them go out of print, even the good ones, and give our best to producing intelligent, articulate critiques that are quickly replaced by the new round of new books and critiquing. And yet, the eventual cumulative effects of our work can be surprisingly significant. The depth of my folkloric research led to many years of criticizing white authors and illustrators for appropriating Native American lore without attribution of tribal identity, permission, and financial contribution for what they appropriated. The power dynamic of stealing from an already oppressed minority would seem self-evident, but the practice was predominant in picture books. My call for source notes in every review and several widely cited articles about it eventually got the attention of publishers, authors, and illustrators, and source notes began appearing more frequently. Coincidentally, while I was writing this lecture, I received some evidence of long-term impact. I'd like to quote parts of a letter mailed to me on February 13 of this month, 2021, 14 years after my retirement. It comes from author-illustrator Roy Freeman, son of Don Freeman of Corduroy fame. How many of you remember Corduroy? Okay. Dear Professor Hearn, wrestling with a book I recently published, Saramsox and Naganox, The Whale Chief, a Tsimshian Legend, I came across your article, Swapping Tales and Stealing Stories, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Folklore and Children's Literature. I wish I had read it earlier. That was back in 1999 that I wrote the article. I've decided to pull Saramsox for further sale and distribution. Although I believe that I, as translator of the tale, and with my personal experiences on the British Columbia coast as a fisherman, like Saramsox, the fisherman in the story, I do retell the story that I feel has universal meaning in a respectful way and offer a percentage of the income to the Metlakatla people. But I feel that in the present cultural context, it is inappropriate that I, with my very individual, not Tsimshian illustrations, publish this book under my name. You discussed many issues in your piece. I'm editing this, it's very long and it's very flattering, so I'll cut that all out. The issues of who can write and illustrate what and how. I don't know if there's a clear solution to the problem of who can tell whose story, who owns a story, and all the subtle differentiations. My father, the late Don Freeman, wrote and illustrated Corduroy, one of the first children's books for the general audience featuring an African-American main character. Could he do this today as a white person? I know that for my father, then living in New York, loving all kinds of people, Lisa and her mother were just his people, maybe his neighbors from the great human mixing pot of New York, like he was himself. There was nothing special about them in terms of color. They were simply people of the city. The color of people around him was no theme, but treating all people of all color fairly and with respect, that was a big theme for him. Now, those of you who have studied this area will recognize Radim Sims Bishop stage of representation of Black characters as the melting pot stage, the first stage. That's exactly what he's talking about, but he doesn't know it. He goes on. Can I write a story about whales? If not, I'm not a whale. That's the whole thing about men. Can men write about women? Can women write about men? I do not know the situation today, but all that you wrote is still very relevant to me and helped me further with Saramsox and with my own directions in future books. No more illustrating and publishing Native American folktales. Although I think they are incredible and should be better known, that is appropriately for their own people to do. I have enough of my own stories to bring to life, and I'm going to focus on those onwards. Ironically, Roy Freeman's book, which is published by a small press and hard to acquire, has a commendable source note. I was impressed with the care and attention he gave to the source and history of the story as it passed from Native oral lore to anthropological lore via Franz Boas to his own aesthetic interpretation. I especially appreciated his impressionistic arts giving so much room for imaginative perception in the narrative. It may sound contradictory, but he seems to me an ideal translator of folklore from cultures other than his own. I take his point about whales being the only legitimate writers about whales, which reflects a longstanding and complex literary debate often carried to extremes. But what I argued for in my reviews and articles is not forfeiture, but respect for and understanding of folkloric power dynamics, which I think he showed strongly in his source note and donation to the tribe. By my own standards, I actually encouraged him to consider a new print run, although I understand that's an arguable position to take. Beyond this specific example, Roy's letter summarizes the importance of reviewers' knowledge and experienced attention to the power dynamics of diversity, and specifically here the power dynamics of folkloric diversity, which we'll undoubtedly hear more from coming speakers. And beyond folklore to a different genre, I believe that booklist reviewer Hazel Rotman's crusade for better documentation in nonfiction for youth had enormous impact on the nature of information available to youth in print sources. Roger Sutton's reviews of LGBTQ books for youth has had lasting impact, as has Deborah Stevenson's expertise in detailing the intricacies of picture book illustration, and Janice Del Negro's deeply informed estimation of storytelling sources during her BCCB editorship. Of the five major editors in the Bulletin's 75-year-old history, each has enhanced our understanding of youth literature in far-reaching ways. Founding editor Mary Kay Aiken promoted the importance of children's books in education after World War II, and the indefatigable Zena Sutherland championed minority rights as well as high literary quality. Let me turn now to a final reflection on the most important aspect of any research project or think piece. In this case, the history and value of BCCB. What's the big so what question? What does it all mean? What are the ramifications and implications? What visions are assumed and projected? First of all, without the Bulletin, there would never have been a Center for Children's Books. In 1945, free books arrived for review at the University of Chicago's Education Department, not the library school. Educators reviewed them. The books needed bookshelves. Bingo, the Center for Children's Books. But so what? Well, the Center for Children's Books anchored the youth services specialization, informed it, embodied it, specifically located it, signified it as an ongoing but constantly changing sociocultural adventure. But so what? Adventure, by its very nature, involves risks, exploits, trials, victories, defeats, boredom, fun. Cloudy, with a chance of meatballs, was fun. Bruce learns about life insurance was not fun. Also, adventure, even episodic adventure, involves a beginning, middle, and end. Both folkloric and both folklore and history are filled with beginnings, middles, and ends because things change. The Bulletin was an arbiter, reflector, and thrall of change, sometimes serially, sometimes all at once. In the course of its history, here are some things that changed. The nature of books for youth, of childhood and adolescence, of reading, of libraries, of library professions, of library schools, of academia, of scholarship, and finally, of the nation's social, cultural, economic, and political climate. And all of these elements changed both cyclically and permanently. Change is a human condition. Remember that in various periods and places, novels were considered corrupting. Folk and fairy tales were considered trash. Print was considered less reliable than word of mouth. Once upon a time, English departments considered children's literature less important than adult literature. Education theorists considered children's books less important than skills and drills. Administrators considered library and information science to be antithetical, which we now know is bullshit. Even children's librarians, generally the heroes of this adventure, for a long time condemned children's reading of substandard materials like commercial mystery and romance series that they considered perfectly fine for adults to relax with. There was the famous, broadly circulated 20th century analogy of junk reading and junk food, both unhealthy. Some of these attitudes I studied, some witnessed, some experienced. I mention these tectonic shifts to introduce my last so what question, the current role of book review journals in relation to youth literature and literacy. Today's readers are tomorrow's leaders. Unfortunately, we recently experienced the singular national disaster of a non-reading leader. Knowledge is power, as we say in the profession, but which knowledge and how that knowledge is accessed make a difference to the nature of power. We see that in the damaging false conspiracy theories perpetrated by some television and social media platforms. 20th century book evaluation tools contributed to collection development and readers' advisory, which certainly varied with community-affected value systems, but which at least had access to currently threatened variety of professional sources. What we see now, as in the case of newspapers and print journals in many disciplines, is either closure or the invisible alternative, absorption into predatory, profit-driven bundles, where knowledge essentially gets locked up behind unaffordable paywalls. BCCB, for instance, is bundled with the very expensive Project Muse. An analogy to bundling, as Deborah Stevenson points out, would be requiring TV viewers to buy an expensive package of channels in order to watch the only two they really want. The economics of this scheme result in an ultimately antisocial, monopolized merger system. Open source distribution that big name journals are now mostly bundled, offer a relatively small counterbalance to published research, given that big name journals are now mostly bundled into corporate packages, either databases like JSTOR or companies like ProQuest that host them. The same, of course, applies to youth literature review journals, as well as book-based research in youth literature, and to school and public library collection development and readers' advisory, as they are starved for affordable review sources or overly dependent, or are overly dependent on the few sources left. Online access. Online access was a lofty ideal. Unfortunately, like universities, it has sometimes been corporatized out of reach. Open source access is a far horizon. I'm going to skip, I think, what's an important quote actually in the Atlantic, but it'll be available in the written source. It is about bundling and its effect, where, for instance, 150 million attempts to read JSTOR are denied at a time where even universities can't afford, some universities can't afford JSTOR. Please note that the distinguished research lecturers following me in this miniseries, two PhDs and an MD, were well-trained with access to books at the Center for Children's Books, which are there, as mentioned, because of BCCB Review Journal. Other UIC units, including English and Education, also use the collection as a resource. The Education Library, like other units, has a fast diminishing budget for books. What would future iSchool students and youth services do without access to new books for youth? How assess the trends, as well as the best, mediocre, and sometimes painfully worst new books, along with older ones that shed light on previous mores, sociocultural dynamics, and aesthetics? How develop experience and judgment calls on evaluation and its mechanisms? Although COVID-19 pandemic has temporarily and perhaps to some extent permanently affected publishing, distribution, and evaluation, there will remain new books for youth and the need to evaluate them. Who will do that and how? It's not that there aren't a lot of opinions out there on the internet, accessible to a lot of people, but something is surely lost without the rigor of training and experience behind professional assessment. As universities and educational nonprofit organizations currently support research in other disciplines, will they continue to support research on books for youth, which requires actually having the books in hand and the expertise to assess them. In spite of lip service to the primacy of literacy, this question has burned a hole in my intellectual and professional life. How would I have written a dissertation without access to collections of children's books and varied opinions of them? How could those who work with children, young adults, and the books they should or want to read be trained at all? The answer at the University of Chicago was a package deal. Liquidation, elimination of both its library school and its education department. I revisited that extreme situation of irreversible cause and effect, only to raise collective and deeply concerning issues of priority. As my colleague Leora Bressler says, we are shaped by what we shape. And as I've written about folklore, the stories that we tell, tell us who we are. This is a prophecy, if you will, make of it what you will. But ask the question, what will be central to the construction of literature and reading? How and by whom will that construction be shaped and told? I commend these questions to you, the audience, all more currently attuned than I am, and all eminently qualified to put your heads together for active thought and thoughtful action. But I will close with the assertion that some part of an answer lies in the iSchool's visionary investment in the Center for Children's Books and the review journal that birthed and nourished it. I finished my story, now it's yours.
Betsy, thank you so much for such a thoughtful and insightful lecture. I think I speak for many in the crowd when I say I could listen to you spin stories all day. I learned so much from you every time we're in conversation. We have just a few minutes for questions, so I invite anyone who would like to ask to type in the chat, and then I will read it out loud. I'm seeing lots of thank yous and appreciations. If you have a question, please go ahead and type it. And again, the lecture and the transcription will be available on the CCB website within the next week. I also want to remind everyone that the 75th anniversary speaker series continues over the next 2 months. I think it's just really especially telling and appropriate that the next three speakers were all students in one capacity or the other of Professor Hearn. So Professor Kate McDowell will be speaking next on March 3rd about storytelling. And then on March 23rd, Sarah Park Dalen will be speaking on advocacy and diversity. And then finishing up the lecture series will be Dr. Dipesh Nasaria, Books Build Better Brains, talking about literacy and youth as a public health issue. So the webinar link that you received for this talk will also allow you to register for each of those three subsequent talks. Yes, as just noted in the chat, there are some big shoes to fill for subsequent speakers. Thank you again.
Can I interrupt you to say that those shoes have long been filled by these students, I'll tell you. what a lucky person I've been.
All right, well, thank you again for sharing your wisdom, and we will, I know that many more people have contacted me to ask about the being able to listen to you and read your words at a later date. So that is forthcoming. Please share with your colleagues and friends. Thank you again, everyone, for helping us kick off this really momentous occasion of 75 years of the Center for Children's Books. Take care.
Kisses to you all and big hugs. to be delivered later after COVID is over.